that has cell phones, we'd like for you to cut those off. And we will just go right into the presentation by Dr. Heather McComber, the board member for Alaska Brain Injury Network. And they're going to give us an update on
concussion management.
Yes.
And if you could give me an idea of how much time before
how much time would you need? We only have an hour and a half, but yes. I know you're not going to talk for
No,
an hour
I'm not
going
to talk for that long. But I just want to make sure that I stay within your time constraints. So
yeah, so you know, the hour and a half is our time. I thought you would go with your presentation. There's a possibility that I might want to take a bill up on the end of mm-hmm. this. So we want you to complete what you have to do and give time for questions and answers if there are any.
Yes, ma'am.
And so we'll just play it by ear. I think you'll be okay.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I am a part of the Alaska Brain Injury Network, and I'm also a member of Alaska Neuro Associates, and we have been managing the concussion program for our Anchorage School District since the House bill was implemented last year. And I want to give you sort of an overview of concussion and what that means and recovery process, and then also talk about our program and what we've done since that bill has been implemented. Concussion is, in this context, from sports where you're hit on the head, obviously, or you have a whiplash injury, and you have maybe a momentary confusion or problems thinking afterwards. It's usually very brief. It's important to remember throughout this presentation that concussions are self-resolving, so this is an injury that will eventually clear up. Most of the concussions that occur do not have a loss of consciousness, so that's a myth that we try to dispel. Any athlete who sustains a concussion is more likely to have a second concussion at least, and thereafter they're likely to have more. Most of the concussions occur in football. That's a pretty violent sport. I think everyone is able to recognize that, and the players are encouraged to hit each other as hard as they can. Concussion awareness has been developing over the past 10 years. We know that similar programs have been implemented across the country in the lower 48. We know that the CDC considers sports concussion at an epidemic level. And it's important to protect these student athletes because their brains are still developing, and so they're more vulnerable for lasting effects. These are sort of the mechanisms of concussion: when you hit your head against something solid or when you spin. And either of those can cause temporary damage. Concussion is not an injury that you're going to see on an MRI or a head CT scan. This is called a metabolic injury. And so what happens is the neurochemicals in the brain are off for a period of time, and they need to regulate back to where they had been prior to the injury. So this is why you can't necessarily test in the traditional manner through a head CT scan or a brain MRI and get a result on concussion. It's important to do this. We want to manage it so that we do not have multiple concussions happening to an athlete within a rapid time frame. We want to get athletes back to play as quickly as possible, and sideline assessment by coaches, athletic trainers, and other staff can identify when a student needs to be sent to the emergency room in critical condition. Second impact syndrome happens rarely, but when it does, it can be fatal. And of all the deaths from second impact syndrome, it occurs in student athletes that are younger than 21. As I mentioned, the brains are not yet finished developing, and so they're more vulnerable to this particular injury. So what happens in this case is that a student athlete sustains a concussion, and before they're fully recovered, they sustain another, and that can lead to brain swelling, bleeding, paralysis, etc. As I mentioned, there's an increased risk of concussion, such that once you have your first, you're more likely to have several thereafter. And once you've had more than three, you're at even greater risk for having a loss of consciousness with your future concussions. You're also more likely to have what's called anterograde amnesia. post-traumatic amnesia, so that you can't remember what happened just after you were hit. And the chances of that increase greatly, as you can see by the statistics up there. So with each concussion, it becomes more serious, and the recovery becomes longer.
It's trying.
It's just not moving. The slideshow.
Do we need to get some help? Oh, that's Chad.
Who's that?
That's a video. It takes probably about 5 minutes to do. We can come back to it if we have enough time at the end. Common symptoms after concussion, you can see here, there's emotional, cognitive, physical, and sleep problems. I've highlighted a few of these because these are the most telltale signs that somebody may have a prolonged or a difficult recovery, headaches being the number one. If you experience an immediate headache, particularly if it's a migraine-type headache, you're probably going to have a poor recovery or a slow recovery, and that's going to complicate things for you at school, at home, with your friends, etc. Individuals who feel foggy after, in terms of their thinking, they sort of feel as if they have cobwebs in their brain, they can't find the information that they would like as quickly as they would like to. Or if you have amnesia, if you can't remember what happened to you prior to or just after you were hit, those are also signs that you're probably going to have a poor recovery or a slow recovery. As I mentioned, this is a self-resolving injury, so most student athletes will recover within a couple of weeks. If you have these three symptoms in particular, you might be looking at a couple of months. One reason that we do concussion management is because an athlete cannot be relied upon for their self-report. We've looked at these in many different ways, these statistics, and most athletes will downplay a concussion primarily because they want to continue to play. They think that their role is very important for their team. And they feel that they're a necessary component of a winning season. And so they won't report it, or they don't want to leave the game. They may not realize that it's happened. So there's many factors that would lead to a student not reporting. When you remove the word concussion from your question to your student athlete, the rate of concussion actually increases dramatically. So when we ask a student athlete, have you ever had a concussion, generally they're going to say no, because they know it's fairly serious and they don't really want that label. But if you remove that and you say, I'm going to tell you a bunch of symptoms and I want you to say if you have had more than five of these symptoms, then they'll say yes to that, and by that method you can identify that they probably have had a concussion. And more likely that they've had two or more. In the past, we relied heavily on neurology guidelines. We assigned way too much weight to loss of consciousness. And these guidelines were pretty poor. There were 14 different scales. They were all quite variable. Sometimes students would be kept out for 3 or 4 weeks. Sometimes they were returned to play immediately or within 15 minutes if they could follow a series of brief commands. So students were at greater risk with these scales. Over the last 10 to 12 years, we have looked more closely at what needs to be done in terms of concussion management for our youth population. And in general, we have determined that we need to remove symptomatic athletes immediately. We need to restrict them from play while they remain symptomatic. There's a graduated return to play protocol. Neurocognitive testing is a cornerstone of this. And then recognizing that there are differences amongst children in their learning style and their performance on neurocognitive measures. As a neuropsychologist, we have a sort of a unique perspective on this problem. We've had lots of training and assessment. We can understand that there are psychiatric issues that are going to play a part here. We were very happy to accept the role as the lead for Anchorage School District in managing this for their student athletes because of our expertise in this area. We unfortunately are the only agency in the state that's using IMPACT, and so we are kept quite busy by it, but we feel that we're able to assess this accurately. The IMPACT program is a 20 to 25 minute test. It covers a range of symptoms, self-report symptoms, and also it looks at attention, memory, reaction time, processing speed, and then it gives us a report as to how the student athlete has performed. And so if you think back to when I said this is a metabolic injury, not something you're going to see on a head CT scan or a brain MRI, you will see this data show that a person is concussed. So this is our sort of our data that leads us to believe that a person has had a concussion. If they cannot process information as quickly, if they cannot respond to test stimuli as quickly, if they can't learn and remember brief, simple stimuli, we know that something has happened. This is a widely accepted measure. It's used in professional teams. It's used internationally. It's used for a wide range of sports and activities. We use this because it enhances our ability to identify concussion accurately. And on the graph here, you can see that on the yellow, those are symptomatic students. They had actually reported that they were experiencing some kind of symptom after being hit. The gray is the body of students that were hit, that was identifiable, but they did not endorse any symptoms. They said they were fine. So these are the athletes that maybe want to continue playing or do not want to be taken out for the season. And even those athletes, you can see, had decrements on neurocognitive testing. And so with the verbal memory and the visual memory, the folks in the red area are those the control subjects, and so they performed as expected. The symptomatic folks performed the worst, but even the asymptomatic folks performed poorly as compared to controls. So we know that this test does give us additional insight into concussion. You may have heard the expression that you've had your bell rung. And this is one of the common problems that we have faced with concussion management, is that coaches, athletic trainers, parents, and students will often say, shake it off, you just had your bell rung, you just get up and you keep going. And so this study examined that phenomenon and looked at students who had just a bell rung kind of situation. And those with just less than 5 minutes of symptoms recovered completely within 7 days, and those with 5 to 15 minutes of symptoms still had cognitive deficits at 7 days. So when you say you just had your bell rung, and visually you're watching somebody who's just been hit, and it doesn't seem to be a bad one, there still can be a poor outcome. And these are the students that would have been returned to play immediately with the old neurology guidelines because they would have appeared to be asymptomatic on the field. A migraine is one of the most common symptoms after a concussion, and it's one of the most telling. And we know that with a migraine, you're probably going to have a prolonged recovery. If you have a history of migraines prior to concussion, you're probably also going to have a longer recovery time. The two are interlinked, and we're not sure exactly why as of yet, but they seem to be, they seem to follow each other pretty closely. There's been several studies thus far that look at the cumulative effect of concussion. With one or two, students are generally fine and the recovery period is not prolonged or exacerbated in any way. Once you get above three concussions, this is where you start to have some long-term adverse effects. You may have a recovery time that can last up to 6 months, or you may have some permanent damage or a permanent change in your level of functioning. Here's some other research that has been done with this particular test, looking at, again, that amnesia is up to 10 times better than loss of consciousness in predicting deficits. So really want to press the point that loss of consciousness is not the identifier that we look for anymore. This is the protocol we follow with concussion management. You'll see at the far left there, there's baseline testing. Before an athlete steps foot onto the field, the pitch, the ice rink, they take a baseline test. It's the exact same test, and that gives us an idea of their particular level of functioning. It tells us where they're at. This allows us to understand that if a student has a learning disability, they may perform poorly on certain measures, and we can expect that after a concussion, we can match it to their premorbid testing or their baseline testing and expect they might still perform poorly on those same measures. After the concussion occurs, your first assessment is within 1 day to 3 days. Repeat assessment as necessary. We repeat this assessment with increased level of physical and cognitive exertion. We know that any kind of physical and cognitive exertion can slow the recovery process. So the first thing that we will do when we have a student that's concussed is put them on full rest if needed. We may let them attend school for a half day, but only audit their classes. We may let them go to their practice and watch, but they cannot participate. As they graduate to return to play, they may go and do skating drills or do running drills, but they can't have any contact with other players. As I mentioned, the baseline is the best point of comparison. So if you have an individual who has some difficulties with language or learning, then we're going to be able to make that comparison pretty easily. Without the baseline, we're comparing to a large normative database, and we're making age-appropriate comparisons, but it does make it a little bit more difficult. In fact, we've had several students who did not have a baseline before this program was rolled out, and we had to keep them out of sport a little bit longer because we had to establish their unique profile. This is also the test that's used in the NFL, and those players do not step foot on the field before they've taken a baseline. So it's an important thing to do. The sideline assessment is completed by a coach, athletic trainer, EMT, anyone who happens to be there watching the game and has some medical background and knows the signs of concussion. And this allows us to say that if there are severe signs, then you can go directly to the ER. If there are not severe signs, then you do the sideline assessment protocol, and you all have cards that walk you through that. In general, we want to remove an athlete from distracting activity and people, including the scoreboard. We try to maintain their full attention, speak in a loud and clear voice, have them perform all of the tasks listed on the card. If they fail any question, the protocol says they cannot return to play and they're referred to the school nurse. There's no do-overs, there's no hints, there's no help in that regard. If they fail, they're out of the game for that particular day. This entire card takes about 2 minutes to execute. It's very fast. And so on the front side, you're going to see that you can observe signs of the student and what they may be experiencing. And it goes anywhere from actual loss of consciousness, even if it is a millisecond, to appears to be dazed, stunned, and confused, if they've forgotten the play or if they forget events after the hit. And then that second column there is symptoms that are reported by the athlete. And sometimes students will be forthcoming with this information, and they seem to be a little bit more aware these days than they are reporting it. On the back of it is the testing protocol. And we've instructed coaches to use their knowledge of their particular student to design this, if they change this if they need to something that would make sense for the student. So for example, some student athletes never remember what the score is. And so we're not going to hold them accountable for that particular question if we know that that's going to be something that's hard for them to do. They may not know what month it is because they're just kind of spacey and that's their normal state of being. But we ask the coaches to use their common sense and their good judgment when they're executing these questions. And importantly, ask them to remember the three words. And again, they can make up their own list of words and run through the questions underneath that and then ask about the three words again. This is an example of the actual test protocol. Words are flashed on the screen twice in the same order. And then the second part of that, we're asking for recognition, and you have to endorse or decline a word that's presented. And then at the end of the test, you'll do the same recognition test again. This is the one that most people hate. We're showing these designs to you in fairly rapid succession, and there are all sorts of squiggly shapes that really don't make any sense, and you can't use any sort of mnemonic devices to try to remember these very well. And then we ask you to recognize them again later. And I can't tell you how many people have said that was the worst test ever. Mm-hmm. But it does work. In Anchorage, when a student is injured and has signs or symptoms, they're pulled immediately. If that protocol on that card is positive, the coach alerts the nurse. The nurse meets with the student. They're referred to us for the impact assessment. We evaluate and determine post-concussion recovery and return to play. So in this scenario, we are the bad guys, which is nice for the nurses, the coaches, the parents, everyone. It takes and relieves that burden for them, and it also puts the coach in a better position so they're not tempted to put their player back in. As I mentioned, they're instructed to rest until symptom-free, so no physical or mental activity. Usually we hear moans and groans from the students when we tell them they can't participate in their favorite sport, but at the same time, they're very happy when we tell them that they also can't do schoolwork. Yeah. Or chores, because that's physical exertion. But then we also say no video games, no texting, no staring at small handheld devices for extensive periods of time. It's a pretty exhaustive list of what we tell them they can and cannot do, and we found that we've had to be pretty detailed because kids are smart and they'll find a loophole. And then once their scores improve to a level that's acceptable within the average range, we'll start reintroducing cognitive and physical activity. And if they're asymptomatic with that activity, then we will repeat until they're completely symptom-free and they've returned to baseline. So we're using this to help determine severity of concussion. Some kids, actually, when they come in, they'll do the protocol and their scores are in the high average superior range and they're cleared that same day and there's no penalty or cost to them whatsoever. Some students, unfortunately, have taken months to recover. It just depends on the nature of the injury and their personal background. We do know that female athletes take longer to recover than male athletes. We know that females report a higher number of concussions than male athletes. We know that if there's a history of migraines, if there's a history of anxiety, depression, or mental health issues, those kids will take longer to recover as well. So all sorts of confounding factors. So we determine the severity of the concussion in the context of that unique context of that student's life. We give the instructions to the student, the parent, we do an education session basically with them, and then we pass that information directly to the school, and the school nurse is responsible for implementation. The school has been pleased with our approach thus far because it does reduce their liability. We have tried to make this as much as possible a team collaboration with all of these parties. Some coaches are very much in favor of this program. Some coaches are very much against it. Some parents are very much in favor. Some parents are against it. We're trying to make sure that everyone understands that we're taking a team approach to get the student back to play as quickly and as safely as possible. So if we have a discrepancy between how the child is at home versus how they are at school versus how they are in our office, we're hoping to resolve those issues and to keep everyone on the same page with the same restrictions in place so they can recover quickly. So for example, we don't want a math teacher assigning homework and holding that student accountable during their period of recovery. Concussions being one of the most serious medical problems at the high school level. Following only car accidents, concussion is the number one source of brain injury for student athletes. Proper management of concussion is the best form of prevention of serious injury. So if you have a concussion once, then you're probably going to get some education after that happens, and then you'll probably be more aware and hopefully reduce your future incident of that. We're hoping to avoid litigation for improper concussion management, students being returned too quickly, for example, and then having second impact syndrome. Thus far, the program has been implemented for, we're going on 1 year here, and you can see that we've done the baselines. Anchorage School District made the baselines mandatory for all of their student athletes, regardless if it's track and field or football. We have not had a sufficient number of post-injury tests. We know that the data suggests that we should have at least a rate of 10 to 15% concussion. For high school football alone, we should have a rate of 20%. So the less than 1% rate of concussion is highly implausible, and there's a few factors that are leading to this. One, it's a brand new program. Another reason is that potentially students are reluctant to discuss their symptoms or their concussion. The rollout was very unexpected. It happened very quickly, and so not enough information was provided to parents. Some parents felt that schools were overstepping their bounds, and they're very angry about the program. Some coaching staff have disagreed with the program as well, and they've undermined the effectiveness of the program. So there have been some problems with it. We've had some coaches not do the sideline assessment and do sort of a visual check of the kid and send them back into play because they don't want to lose the player for the rest of that game or that season. We've had students underreporting because they're very fearful of a prolonged or an excessive recovery time. When the program first started, I had one student athlete and his mother in my office. They were from Fairbanks. I'm sorry, they were from Anchorage, but they had regulations from Fairbanks, and apparently in Fairbanks they said that students would just be out for 6 weeks. And so they had brought this official form from the Fairbanks School District to my office and demanded to know that why would the son be kept out for 6 weeks. It's not the protocol we follow, but this is the misinformation that led to this kind of fear response. Teachers and support staff sometimes unwilling to meet students' needs or grant accommodations. I've had teachers tell students that, geez, you were really on track for having a 95% in my class, and now it's just going to go out the window. That's too bad for you. We've had teachers unwilling to make accommodations when students have returned to full activity and they have a backlog of work that they have to try and make their way through in an ant-like fashion. And they've just held them to the standards they had pre-injury instead of sort of selecting out what projects or activities might be most important for grading. A few coaches, because our program is such that we give a code, an access code, and it's the same code, which this is something we're revising now. They've directed the students to retake the baselines to assess concussion themselves. They have no training in this area, but they've done it anyway because, again, they don't want to lose their player. Some students performed deliberately poorly on the baseline, thinking that if they did poorly initially, then our ability to measure the severity of their concussion later would be compromised and they would sort of trick us. We have tests of effort that are done in the testing. We know what they're doing. Baselines have sometimes been conducted in less than optimal conditions. Maybe they're doing this at home. The baselines are done either at school or home. They're not coming into our office to do it. That's the way it is. It's an online test. We expect that a parent who's interested in their child's health will be making sure that the child is in a quiet area taking the test and they're attending to the test stimuli. We're assuming that coaches and nurses who are monitoring or acting as a proctor for the group of students taking it together in the computer lab would be monitoring student activity and making sure they're paying attention. That doesn't always happen. There's been some financial constraints and problems for the program. We had thought there was grant money for uninsured or underinsured students, and we directed them to several families to this supposed grant money, only to learn that it was for individuals who are 18 and up. That was very disappointing. Some insurance have high copays, so the baselines themselves are $5. It's very inexpensive. The post-concussion program is submitted to students or their parents' insurance program. Some codes are denied or an insurance is unwilling to pay for assessment. In particular, Medicaid is difficult in this regard because two of our codes that we routinely use and are paid for and accepted by all other insurance carriers are not covered by Medicaid, and that makes it challenging. There's no additional financial source to alleviate patients' financial burden. TRICARE, for whatever reason, regularly goes through intervals when they deny pre-authorization for any testing. And so that leaves service members and veterans without support. And we need greater assistance in rural areas so that we can use telemedicine. It would be fantastic if we could, because it's an online program, if we could connect through Skype and assess these students in the remote areas that do not have a professional in their immediate vicinity. We've had several students actually from Juneau flown to Anchorage for post-concussion evaluations because the doctors here weren't comfortable with making that determination themselves. This could have been answered easily through a telemedicine protocol and less expensively. So some key points, and then if folks are interested, you can take a look at the video. Sports concussion is a hidden epidemic. A bell ringer is a concussion. Amnesia, headaches, and fogginess are better predictors. Concussed athletes need to rest, and failure of sideline testing means they do not return to play. Always have someone with a concussed athlete after injury. Send them to the ER if there's severe symptoms, and the team needs to stay on the same page. So at a fairly rapid pace, that is the presentation. Are folks interested in seeing the video, or should we have discussion?
Sure.
Video?
It's up to the chairman now.
We all do.
She's the boss, Dave.
Out of full speed, and just bam, collided with another girl on the other team.
On the kickoff, I got speared in the side of the head.
Aaron hit the ground, head hit first.
A concussion is when there has been an injury to the brain that has led in an alteration of function. Notice, nowhere did I say that it must include loss of conscience.
See if we can speed it up and go back to the spot we were.
We were running at each other full speed and just bam, collided with another girl on the other team.
On the kickoff, I got speared in the side of the head.
Aaron hit the ground, head hit first.
A concussion is when there has been an injury to the brain that has led in an alteration of function. Notice, nowhere did I say that it must include loss of consciousness.
I've never felt that kind of pain before, especially with my head. I was so dizzy, woozy, didn't know really what was going on.
She became lethargic, tired. She kind of just withdrew into herself.
I completely blacked out, and I didn't fall, you know, I was still standing, but it kind of came on like a really, really old TV. Like, I don't know if you remember, like, your grandma's house or something. There was, like, a big wooden cabinet TV, and you turn it on, and it's just, like, a little pinprick of light, and then kind of opens up, and the TV's on. Like, that's what I saw.
I could look at her, and I could see in her eyes when she was having difficulty with the headaches and the headache, nausea, dizzy shutdown mode that you get in when she was trying to process information. But then she became nauseous. This was about an hour after her concussion, threw up.
And when I walked off the field of play, my coach was yelling at me because I missed the tackle afterwards after I got hit and blacked out. And I went over by the cheerleaders and threw up into a garbage can. I was sick right away.
Throughout the rest of the game, throughout the rest of that night, like, there's a lot of spots that I don't remember what I did.
She did not get up right away. She did not become unconscious, but she did not get up right away. Her coach immediately pulled her from the game and did not let her return to play. As much as she wanted to, he would not put her back in the game, which I was extremely thankful for afterwards.
The trainer came over and she like examined me, with followed her finger, stuff like that, and then she like took my helmet once she said that and said, you're not going back in. I said, oh, come on, I have to go back in. We were winning, we ended up losing the game, but as soon as they were done checking me, they looked over the stands and called my mom down, and I knew that was a bad sign.
Part of being a kid and a teenager is this feeling of invincibility, but over the past couple years, I've had to realize that that's just not true.
Remember that if you suffer a concussion, you're probably not going to perform at the level you're capable of. So not only is it not going to help out the team or help out your individual performance, but could be dangerous for not just that season, but for the rest of your life.
Certainly after my first experience of getting a couple concussions at a time, that the more it happened, the more severe it was, and the harder it was to bounce back, you know. Difficulty just keeping things together in school and finishing tests on time, needing extra time to do things and just kind of put together ideas in class afterwards. Definitely the recovery time got a lot longer, and you know, in the case of the last time I hit my head, I mean, it was years before I felt more or less normal.
The proper evaluation and return to play can avoid catastrophic events. And again, not to scare anyone that's listening, but there are things called second impact syndrome, etc., where a very mild blow to the head of someone who's not yet fully recovered can lead to a very rapid sequence of events that can lead to the demise of the athlete.
This is your child's brain, and this is their future. It's not worth, while she's a great soccer goalie, it's not worth her future to put her at risk again.
If you have had anything that caused you to have a change in your ability to function mentally, whether it's remembering things or being able to focus, whether you had some subtle dizziness or slight headache, that you go to someone that can help you get to the proper care.
Get the facts and know what to do if a concussion occurs. Visit BIAB.net.
I think that's a pretty good video that gives an overview of things that can happen.
Could you go back? You said some parents think it's over. Some parents agree with what we're doing at this point.
Yes.
Some don't.
Yes.
The thing is, for is the coaches are,
yes,
concerned.
That is correct.
But do you feel that we're getting a fair assessment about what's going on? How do you actually come into it? Because you say, during your presentation, that it can be the coach or somebody that's working with them, or the nurse, or someone,
yes,
can call the shots as to where a youngster could go back in without having had
that
you assess them.
Yes, that has happened. So how are we getting accurate numbers? It depends by school and by region. We've had certain schools where there's one school in particular that the nurse is fantastic, and whenever she even sniffs the possibility of concussion, we get all of those students. She is self-identified neuro-Nazi is what she calls herself. We have other school districts, the smaller portion of the school district where the folks have just not been happy about the program whatsoever, and they have basically tried to manage it themselves without referring kids in. And we've had those students come in, and they've said that my coach saw me get tackled twice, and they saw me have trouble standing up the second time, and nobody said anything, and no sideline assessment was completed.
So if that happened, the student come in to you, then what actions are taken as far as you reporting that back to the school?
We do report back to the school. We have had conversations with the administrative staff at the school and the district. And they have tried to address that internally. I'm not sure how far that went, because that we don't have the ability to understand what their process is. But we do let the schools know what's happened.
I know that legislation is not always the answer, but it might be some suggestions that may need to be made to the legislators in order to say these are the things that are not working. I don't know if you need to do anything to enforce that by adding something else into the statute or making sure that it's been done, because if people are going to be able to do what they want to do, then they will continue to do what they want to do at the jeopardy of the students. Because I'm more concerned about those 18 and under, those in school.
Yes.
Now, the grown people, you know, if they choose to do that, that's something they can deal with. You also said that there was grant monies, and who was to have this grant money? Where did the money come from?
That I cannot tell you off the top of my head. I could get that information to you. It was for individuals who had suffered a traumatic brain injury, and they had to apply through an agency called LINX in the Valley, and the grant money was up to $2,000 per year, and we thought we were good to go with it, and we sent a few families there, and unfortunately it's just for 18 and older. And there was, as far as we were told by that agency, there was no room for maneuvering and allowing for student athletes. We did ask, but that was not available.
Do you know if, in the school programs, do they have to have insurance in order to play sports?
They do not, as far as I understand it. So the family assumes that financial risk.
I don't want to ask all the questions.
Well, I just want to follow up with the chair. Why in the world would a parent be opposed to something like this?
There's been some misperception about the program, as I mentioned. I did indicate that we're the only two, myself and Dr. Cherry, the only two in the state doing the IMPACT program, which baffles us. We really don't understand why that is the case, but nonetheless it is. Some of the parents felt as if they were being forced into our office. Some of the parents felt as if their primary care physician should be able to clear their son or daughter from concussion, despite the fact that that person generally doesn't have knowledge about concussion recovery. And so they felt as if they were being strong-armed in some way. And as I mentioned, the rollout was pretty abrupt, and I don't think that the schools had enough time to prepare sufficient literature and educational materials for the families and bring them on board in a way that would have made the buy-in better.
But they're doing this in the NFL, they're doing it in
yes.
the NCAA. I mean, there was a big...
Yes.
I mean, everybody was so happy they were doing it, and now yes. high school sports, they're... It just doesn't make much. Never mind.
Well, and in fact, we, besides Hawaii, we were the last state to have the IMPACT program. Dr. Cherry and I joined at Providence in 2005. That's when we started together. And almost from the beginning, we started advocating for this program to be brought here. We brought the originators of the program from University of Pittsburgh up to Providence and helped with the implementation and the design of the program when we were at Providence. We've since transitioned to private practice, but we've been advocating for this program for years now and trying to get something put through. We were very happy that the bill passed. We just want to make sure that the kids obviously remain safe and enjoy their youth and their sport.
Great, thank you.
Yes, Senator Barr, did you have a question also?
I do, yes. Thank you, Dr. McCumber, for that presentation. It's very educational. A couple questions. So now your background is a...
neuropsychologist.
So that's a psychologist that specializes in the brain, is that?
Correct.
Okay. Now, when kids have these concussions, it's considered a brain injury?
It's considered the mildest form of brain injury, and it generally does resolve in our youth in a 1 to 2 week time frame. For adults, it's usually 3 to 5 days. For the younger, the pediatric population, it can be up to a month. So as the younger the person is, the longer the recovery time.
And it seemed like in watching that video there that this can be permanent? This brain damage?
With successive concussions that happen pretty quickly, yes. You can have some bad outcomes that last for years until they resolve or that are permanent. And with the brain bleed or swelling, those conditions tend to be permanent because you tend to need a craniotomy and brain surgery after.
That was going to be my next question. It's like, I know with a knee you can get it fixed surgically. Can you surgically fix a brain?
If there's a bleed or if there's a swelling or edema, then there are things you can do. But for a regular standard concussion, rest is the protocol. So that neurometabolic mismatch chart that I showed you, where it's basically a bruise in the brain, and the bruised area wants more glucose. And so anything that you do physically or cognitively that would take away from that bruised area's ability to get glucose, you're prolonging your recovery. So rest allows for that glucose-hungry area to eat as much as it can and needs and wants.
Okay. This is just an area of interest of mine because I'm interested in the area of FAS, fetal mm-hmm. alcohol syndrome, and which is just, my understanding, damage to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if that damage could be fixed surgically, but I know I'm getting off subject here. So now in Anchorage, you referred to how we do it in Anchorage. Mm-hmm. I'm from Anchorage as well. You said that immediately the athletes pulled off the field and brought into your office for assessment. Is that not the standard we do statewide? Or
no, I don't believe so. I really can't speak to what happens in the rest of the state, unfortunately. As I mentioned, in Fairbanks, I believe they implemented a system that removes athletes for up to 6 weeks. I'm not sure what happens in Juneau. I have seen a few kids coming over from Juneau. I'm not sure what the protocol is here.
Madam Chair, I wonder if this is something we should work through Commissioner Hanley's office, Department of Education, and get this out, that this is going to be the standard for all high schools.
The standard right now indicates that a student athlete must be cleared by a person who is certified in concussion management. And that certification is left to the professional to determine if they are certified or not. There is no standard certification that one could achieve. Through the IMPACT program, you are considered a credentialed certified individual who can use this program, and that certifies you. There are organizations that would allow you to be a certified individual after a 12-week online course. So there are avenues, and I guess the individuals who don't have this kind of background would say that they're certified because they've seen a lot of this or they've read a lot about this. But typically we get these referrals because honestly nobody else wants them. The neurologists don't want them. They send them to us.
Okay. And Madam Chair,
yes.
A lot of football teams anyway have an athletic trainer.
Yes.
Are they, in your opinion, qualified to make this assessment, or does it need to be done by?
No, they're not. And for some of the reasons that were on some of the slides in terms of background information that would be really informative for that decision-making process. So, for instance, a young woman who has a history of anxiety and depression comes in and she's been concussed, and the concussion or the incident sounds maybe moderate, and we would expect her recovery to occur over the course of 3 weeks, and for these other reasons, it takes 3 months, and that's somebody that has to be monitored pretty carefully. Because the liability issue is that if you release them before their scores are good, and something happens, then you're on the line for that. So I don't think athletic trainers have the assessment background. Number one, I don't think they've had rigorous study in the area of assessment, and I don't think that they have the background in terms of the psychological, emotional aspects of this.
Madam Chair, I didn't mean that much. That wasn't the assessment, I guess I was referring to.
Oh, the sideline. Yes,
as far
absolutely.
As doing the card.
Absolutely.
And,
coaches,
yeah.
Athletic trainers, EMTs, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, because I can see some coaches not wanting to mess with that and saying, okay, athletic trainer, you go through the card with them. And
we have gone through the card with the Anchorage coaches, all of them, step by step.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, do you report all the incidents back to the school district from which the student came from?
Yes, we give them data on that student, and we give the specific limitations or restrictions that the student must abide by until they're recovered. And then the nurse takes that information and makes sure the teachers follow that.
So that's the only reported system that you have. You don't do anything back to the Department of Education?
We do not.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other question? I really appreciate that, but I see there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Now, we passed a bill, you know, you want to know if it's working or not. So you've given us an indication that in some instances it is working, but in other things there needs to be some oversight to that. And I don't know who promulgated the regulations. I thought DED, but I'm not sure. So we have to do some checking around. You have given us good information that we can go back now and try to follow through on what's this done, because we were feeling real good. At least I know I was when we passed the bill, thinking, hey, we've done a good thing here, and this situation is going to be taken care of.
You absolutely have done a good thing with this. And without this bill, there would be no groundwork in this at all. You know, we would... It's a start, and it's not yet even the first year complete. Yeah. So I'm glad to see that, if nothing else, we have over 8,000 baseline students.
Great.
So if something does happen to any of those baseline students, we can compare their data. So if nothing else, that's a good start.
Yes. And thank you so much. We appreciate it. Yes.
One more quick question.
Senator Morris?
Did you say yourself and Dr. Cherry, the only two that are –
That's
dealing
correct.
With this? Because there are other neuropsychologists, I believe, in Anchorage and probably statewide.
Yes, there are approximately 6 in the entire state. We are an underserved state for our profession. So that's why it makes it particularly challenging if, for instance, Medicaid codes aren't reimbursed or TRICARE decides that they're not going to pre-authorize our services, because those families don't have anywhere else to go.
You did mention TRICARE, so I understand that's the military part of it.
That is correct.
What about private insurance? Are they falling through on?
Yes, generally they are.
Okay.
The Blue Cross, the Aetnas, UBH, all of those generally take care of their, you know, whatever co-pays that person has. Unfortunately, that's their own financial burden, but they do generally reimburse.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
There's one other item I assume my committee now. We're done with the presentation, and I do have a quorum, and we have given out the information on Denali KidCare, a bill that's been returned to my committee. And I think within the 30 minutes that we have left, we could at least go over the new CS. Do you have that in your packages? Okay. I would like for my staff to come up and give an overview of the changes that have been made and compare that to the original bill with the new CS.
Madam Chair, it's just the version I.
But I need someone to say, yes, it's okay. Version I, so if my vice chair would bring this up, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move CS for Senate Bill number 5 of 27LS0057/I.
All right, and I'll just object for the discussion of it. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Overmeyer. I think everything that you need is in your package.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the bill before you is Senate Bill 5, the CS, the committee substitute version. 27LS0057I as an indigo. The changes that have been made were in response to pulling it back from the Senate committee in order to increase the 200% federal poverty guideline only for children 13 and under. So there will be less opposition to pregnant women and those children ages 13 through 19 in the previous version, 175% to 200%. So the changes that were made is that in the title of the bill, you'll notice now there we pulled pregnant women out of the title and inserted on the on page 4, really 4 changes. You'll notice under subsection 13 and 14, we changed it from 200% to 175% of those individuals I just described, pregnant women and children or persons under 19 will remain at 175. They're still eligible at the level they were authorized under the previous statute. But subsection 16, lines 15 through 18 on page 4, is entirely new. And it reads, persons under 13 years of age who are not covered under subsection A of this section and whose household income does not exceed 200% of the federal poverty line, as defined by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and revised under 42 U.S.C. 99022. This is the change, the primary change in the bill. It limits the eligibility to just children, essentially, ages 13 and under. And this addresses, to a large extent, the concern, I think, that was experienced through the department and through the governor and others in the legislature as to the issue in increasing eligibility to 200% for all members that might involve pregnant women and the possibility of abortions. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. This is a last minute effort on the part of Senator Davis to try to keep this bill active and to also bring in almost 1,000 children. This is going to bring in 968 more children into the Denali Kid Care program who otherwise would be uninsured. And that has a tremendous amount of merit in itself, even though it is not everything that Senator Davis wanted in the bill.
Any questions at this time from members?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and I. You're in an area here I know nothing about, but I'm assuming that there has been no pregnancies under the age of 13.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, it's my understanding that it's technically possible. It's rare in this program to find a child under age 13, and they have statistics on this. I don't have all of them with me, but it's extremely rare to find that.
Okay.
There's a possibility that a child under 12 years old, 12 and under, could have a child. You know, it depends. And I can't give you information saying that before we've had any cases such as that. Something, if you want answers to that, I could see what the department could provide, but I assumed they would provide very little because it was only like a small percentage of the money that was being used for abortions in the first place. So they never were able to come up with the number that was actually being paid out of the Denali Kid Care money because it was paid by Medicaid. And then the rest of them that the federal government would pay for, the three areas that they would pay for, we already know that. So we can't get around those things, but as far as 0 to 12, will it be possible that somebody might get pregnant within that? It's a possibility. It's definitely not impossible because girls do now begin to have a move into womanhood early, some 11, 10, 9.
And, Madam Chair, if I could correct myself, I think I said 13 and under. It's really, as you mentioned, 12 and under. As under 13. The draft read under age 13, but it's really 12 and under.
12.
Yes, yeah, that's correct.
So the bill is covering 0 to 12, to age 12. And you have the changes that have been made, and that they're very slight, just the removing the pregnant woman out of the equation and anyone over 12 years old in this particular version of the bill. And you do have also with your package is the physical note. And it's my understanding with children only that the federal government would pay the full 70% of the bill rather than 50% as they were paying for pregnant women.
Madam Chair, if I could speak to the fiscal note. The fiscal notes that just came out from the department are entirely wrong. They were drafted for the previous bill,
And they said until this committee substitute was adopted, I just got that information this morning, they could not give us new numbers.
So the numbers that we have in front of us are not the right numbers?
No, in fact, they
Because I compared the numbers that they gave us to the numbers they gave me with their original bill, and they are different.
They're up. They're higher. In fact, they went up quite a bit, and it's because of inflation. And it was all predicated on 1,277 children, 218 pregnant women coming into the program. We no longer have the pregnant women. We no longer have 1,300 children. We have less than 1,000. So it's only children that we're going to have in the new fiscal note. And I think that could be promptly revised because I suspect in the fiscal note that they just generated that they have a cost per child that could just be multiplied by 968 and we'll have the numbers that we need. But I could not get it out of them over the weekend until it was adopted by the committee and passed out by the committee.
Thank you very much. That's all I need to know. We have heard the bill. We have adopted the bill. I will then look for them to have me a physical note by Wednesday because it's my intention to bring this bill back to the committee on Wednesday to move it out of this committee. And if you don't have any other questions or comments to be made, we are adjourned.